Merchant versus Bauer. Mr. Jackowitz, did I pronounce that pretty badly?
Close enough. Yeah, I say Jaskowitz, but as a, I tell people, we don't even say it all the same way in the family, so I know who you're talking to. Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Ben Jaskowitz. I am an assistant county attorney for Fairfax County, Virginia, and I'm here representing the appellant, Officer Robert Bauer of the Fairfax County Police Department. This case is a little bit of a change of pace from what you've been hearing so far this morning. This is a civil rights 1983 case. The issue was whether or not the district judge erred in denying summary judgment on an assertion of qualified immunity made by the officer. The 1983 claim is that the officer did not have probable cause under the Fourth Amendment to arrest the plaintiff, who is the appellee here, Dr. Rose Merchant, for impersonating a law enforcement officer in violation of Virginia law. In preparing for this case, I thought about maybe how I could pitch it to you a little bit different in the brief so that it'd be a little more interesting. And I really think what it comes down to when you go back, you review the case law, you look at the facts of this case, is that this case, the district judge's opinion, simply doesn't square with this court's prior precedents. In particular, it does not square with this court's precedent in Watkins versus Arnold, which was a 2000 case that actually Judge King wrote. Watkins versus Arnold is remarkably similar to this case in several ways that I think the district court overlooked, and I'd like to highlight those for you. First of all, Watkins versus Arnold did not involve the same sort of an offense we have here, and I want to make that clear at the outset. It actually involved a check fraud case. It was a Fourth Amendment claim that there was not probable cause to arrest the plaintiff in that case for a check fraud. And the underlying facts that are important is that this plaintiff had apparently signed his name and the name of a lender on this check. He had signed his name twice. And the district judge in that case is very concerned about the fact that he just couldn't believe that somebody would sign their name twice if they were intending to commit fraud. And this court said, well, you need to look at the totality of the circumstances, as of course you always do in probable cause, and see what those circumstances were. And in that case, they decided that the circumstances were sufficient that the officer had probable cause. Now, I'm not arguing probable cause here today. I'm arguing that there should be qualified immunity because a reasonable police officer could have believed there was probable cause. But I think the point that Judge King was making there is district judges need to set aside what they may think in their own minds makes sense or not make sense and look at the facts of the case. We have a similar situation here. One of the things, in fact, I think arguably the thing that most bothered the district judge in this case about what happened is that he could not believe that somebody would try to impersonate themselves as a law enforcement officer to a uniform law enforcement officer. He just could not believe that that would occur. And my response, with all due respect to the district court, is look at the facts. The facts are...
I thought she said consistently that she wasn't a law enforcement officer.
No, no, sir. She never said that. She said she was in public safety. She said she was deputy of the Department of Corrections. She said she wanted professional courtesy. She referred to
public safety, Department of Corrections.
Yes. But there are both uniformed and non-uniformed people in the Department of Corrections.
Well, what part of that statement was incorrect?
Well, the issue here, Your Honor, is not whether or not the statement was incorrect. The problem is that my officer, subsequently after hearing these statements, contacts the Internal Affairs Division for the Prince George's County Department of Corrections, and he is told certain things that simply in his mind, and I believe in the mind of a reasonable police officer, which of course is the standard here, don't square.
First of all,
she represents that she has a police car. He's told she doesn't have a police car. Second of all, she continually says she's in public safety.
Isn't it undisputed that she was issued a county issued vehicle for her use?
That's undisputed, but what's also undisputed, and the district court was very careful about this, is that there's nothing in the record that indicates that the officer knew that at the time.
She said police car with air quotes.
Right.
Every time.
Yes, sir.
Every time.
But then he's told something different a day later. He's told something different a day later.
What was he told a day later?
He's told she didn't have a police car.
That's his testimony?
Yes, sir. That's undisputed.
What do you mean it's undisputed?
I mean, it's undisputed.
You mean the people from Prince George's County corroborated that they told him she did not have, quote, a police car?
Well, I don't, that has not been put in, that was never an issue in this case.
Well, then it's not undisputed, right?
It is undisputed. It is undisputed. There's no dispute in the record that he was told by the head of the Internal Affairs Bureau for Prince George's County that she did not have a police car. She had not been issued a police car.
But she didn't say she had a police car.
Yes, she did.
She put it in quotes.
Yes, sir, but my point...
Put it in quotes. She said, I work in public safety.
I'm,
I work in public safety.
That's true.
She was second in charge at the Department of Corrections.
That's right, and she also asked...
And that was all true.
Well, she also asked for professional courtesy, which I think a reasonable law enforcement officer could infer means that he's a fellow law enforcement officer. She also has a badge that she doesn't show him when he asks to see
the
badge.
Is a correctional officer a law enforcement officer in the mind of a reasonable police officer?
I don't think that there, according to the record in this case, apparently there are some people who are civilians, and there are some people who are not civilians who are correctional officers.
I'm not asking about whether you're a civilian or a sworn member of an armed law enforcement agency. Don't people refer to probation officers as law enforcement officers? And a lot of probation officers think of themselves as law enforcement officers.
Well, the fact of the matter is she wasn't a law enforcement officer.
She was in charge of a whole posse of law enforcement officers.
That doesn't make her a law enforcement officer, Your Honor.
You know.
I mean, the question here is, could a reasonably objective law enforcement officer or police officer believed that she was a law enforcement officer? And I believe that there was sufficient facts for probable cause. It doesn't mean there was sufficient facts to find her guilty.
What would be the objective under these circumstances of her purporting to be a law enforcement officer?
Well, that's not in the summary judgment record. There's a lot of other things going on in this case.
I think so, too, because it seems to be a little strange to me that someone says, I'm a public safety officer, and said, and he did find out that she did work there, right?
Yeah.
Correction?
Yes, sir.
And the police officer still insist on bringing charges against her when she didn't say, I'm a law enforcement officer. She said, I'm a public safety officer with the Department of Corrections, and that part is correct?
Yes, but that could include somebody in law enforcement.
It could, but she didn't purport to mean anything other than what she said it was, public safety.
But the problem is that he gets additional information.
Which is what?
Which is that she's a civilian, that she doesn't have a police car, and at least if we accept the district court's version of the facts, which we must, that's only some people in the Department of Corrections were entitled to have a badge.
All right, so he found that she couldn't have a badge.
No, he didn't find that out. He could have drawn that inference. That would be our argument.
Well, he didn't even take
a reasonable officer could have drawn that inference.
He didn't look at whatever he talked about, the badge thing.
He asked her for the badge, and she didn't show it.
He didn't know what she had.
Your Honor, my argument would be, and the argument in our brief is, that a reasonable law enforcement officer could conclude from the fact that she didn't show him the badge, given the comments, the statements that she made, that there's something peculiar about that, that perhaps she's not who she says she is, that perhaps she isn't holding herself out honestly.
As it turns out, your client got a warrant for it, and they fired her, and she was tried over there up there in Virginia, and the judge said, you don't have a case, and threw it out, right?
Well, that's right, but that's not probable cause.
You're going to say none of that's relevant, but we got to look at what's in his mind. And the question that I believe that Judge Ellis left out there was that, or the point he left out there, maybe there's a factual issue here, and there is a factual issue here. He can present it in the trial of this case, right? That's all he said was, this case goes to trial. He's not entitled to a court ruling that he's entitled to immunity at this stage.
No, I don't. I'm not sure I completely understand you, but that from what I'm hearing,
well,
I don't agree.
What part don't you understand?
Okay, well,
what did Judge Ellis rule then?
Judge Ellis ruled that the undisputed facts were insufficient to support qualified immunity. There was a fact.
Undisputed facts.
That's right.
Was insufficient for qualified immunity.
Right.
So there are sufficient disputes of fact that permit the case to go forward.
Well, but he basically, what he did on the one factual dispute is.
Trial, he would be entitled to defend on what basis? Acted in good faith. Is that right?
Well, no, I think he would be entitled to defend on most of the facts here. The factual dispute in this case that Judge Ellis basically...
He hadn't been found... The point I'm trying to make, he wasn't found to be liable for anything. He was denied qualified immunity.
That's right, and that's why my argument is that...
And we can grant qualified immunity if there are undisputed facts.
That's correct.
That are sufficient to show it.
And
that's what we have here now. This is an interlocutory appeal, right?
Yes, sir. You are correct. Yeah, and the one fact dispute that he put aside and he assumed in favor of the plaintiff was this issue about whether or not my client was told by PG County that she did not have authorization to have a badge. And what the judge said is, there's a fact dispute on that, but I'm going to assume, based upon my reading of the record, that the most that can be said is that he wasn't told anything one way or the other. That all he was told was that some people in the Department of Corrections are issued badges. And that's the record we're here on.
Well, she didn't purport the badge to be, didn't display it for authority, correct? This badge gives me the authority to do anything, correct?
I would have to say yes, that's true.
All right.
But the problem, again, is that there's also this case, this counsel case from the Virginia Court of Appeals that my client relied on, which has at least some factual similarity to what happened here. In that case, the person who was impersonating a law enforcement officer had a badge. And he made statements that were suggestive, and I think that's the key word that the Court of Appeals used, were suggestive of being a member of a law enforcement entity. One of the things here in this case is that there's all this talk about, well, she didn't expressly do this, that, or the other thing. That's fine if you look at the statute and if you look at the first half of the statute. But look at the end of the statute where it talks about somebody who assumes or pretends to be a law enforcement officer. That's what my client was focusing on. And this Court of Appeals case, which happens to be the only case out there that interprets this statute, which of course starts to raise the red flag in my mind, at least about whether the law is clearly established, is if it's suggestive, then that doesn't mean you have to come straight out and say something. You don't have to come straight out and misrepresent yourself, that there is room in the joints.
Counsel, wait for the question?
Yes, sir.
Here, you don't have to assume that she said what she was. And you don't have any evidence to say to the contrary. Is that correct? She said, I'm a public safety officer with the Department of Correction. Is there anything in the facts of this case that said that's not true?
Your Honor?
Yes or no?
No.
All right. Now, you want to explain further your no?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I apologize if I've in any way upset you.
Go ahead. No, just
Your Honor?
Explain your no.
She made a series of statements. A reasonable officer could believe that those statements, that series of statements, I'm in public safety, I'm second in charge, I demand professional courtesy, my sheriffs know about warrants, I have a police car in my driveway. After talking then to Prince George's County and finding out that she's a civilian.
What do you mean by she's a civilian?
That she's not a uniformed, that she's not a law enforcement officer.
She never said she was.
Right.
Said she worked in public safety, second
but,
in charge.
Your Honor, but I think let me try a different tact. The Supreme Court has said in Hunter versus Bryant, which I think I did cite in my brief, that the question on qualified immunity is not whether there's a more reasonable or another reasonable way to read the facts. The question is there a reasonable way to read the facts that supports qualified immunity? My argument would be that there is a reasonable way to read these facts, that a reasonable officer could have taken the statements that she made, armed with the information that he received from Prince George's County, along with the fact that she doesn't show the badge, along with the fact that he's read this case from the Virginia Court of Appeals, which is the only thing he has to go on, and a reasonable officer could conclude.
Is he some frustrated law student?
Pardon me?
You really say he read this case from the Virginia Supreme Court?
Our police officers do that. They do check
they
the
do.
Law. Yes, sir. They check the law. Yes,
a little too clever by half, I suppose.
Well, I mean, Your Honor.
I mean, you know, the facts of this case cry out for something. I don't know. Clearly, there's not enough crime in Fairfax County, with all respect, if this officer thinks this is the kind of thing he ought to be spending his time on.
Well, Your Honor, he did
now,
go
that
to...
doesn't disqualify him from qualified immunity. But, you know, some cases just stare at you and you think, what on earth is going on here, frankly?
Well, Your Honor, my argument is that I believe that a reasonable officer could look at these facts and conclude that there was probable cause. That doesn't mean that a reasonable officer couldn't go the other way, too.
And the case he's relying on is this English versus Commonwealth,
yes,
right?
Sir. Yes, sir. You're correct.
That's the case he said he read, so mm-hmm. in the Court of Appeals, he read and
yes,
he relied
sir.
On. And there, a bounty hunter actually pulled over the motorist,
mm-hmm.
right, on the highway and falsely displayed a badge. Indicating he was part of a special investigation unit.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying that's similar to this?
I think it's similar enough. Again, the case doesn't, I don't think the case has to be on all fours any more than a case has to be on all fours for the law to be clearly established.
Counsel, I tell you, you're a master of understatement. Talk about not being on four. He stops the car with the show of authority. That's the big difference.
Well,
if this lady had said, wait a minute, I'm in charge here. I'm a law enforcement officer. I have the authority to tell people what to do. And then proceeds. Here, the lady cooperated, didn't have to talk to the police officer at all about an investigation about someone ran someone off the road or used lights. She's talking to the police officer, cooperating. And in that conversation, she says several things. One in terms of, well, first of all, she's trying to, and the police car would come up in terms of, because wasn't it about whether or not the car had some kind of lights in it?
That was a different issue, Your Honor.
A different issue?
Yes, sir. That was a different issue.
But when she said that she's a public safety person, what was she purporting to, what was the gang say there?
Well,
I
understand what you're saying, Judge Gregory, and I guess what I'm saying is you can, it's a zone. You know, as this court has said, we provide qualified immunity in gray areas, and I think that the imagery of a gray area suggests that there can be more than one interpretation of the facts that can be reasonable.
We agree with that proposition.
Okay, yes,
sir. We're not going to make any rulings going to run counter to that. We agree with that.
Yeah, I just
your red light's on. Why don't we give Mr. Bynum
sure.
an opportunity?
Thank
you'll save some time. We appreciate it.
May it please the court,
yes, sir.
Kenneth Bynum for the appellee, Dr. Merchant. Your Honors, this case, from the time I became involved in it, has been a very peculiar case for me. But going through the analysis that this court must, the district court, I believe, was acted properly when it first made a determination of whether or not, given the evidence that was undisputed, whether or not there was a violation of my client's Fourth Amendment's rights to be unlawfully seized. And in doing so, the question became, what were the undisputed facts? The undisputed facts were that she always consistently said that she was the deputy director of the Department of Corrections, that she was in public safety. She never said that she was a police officer. She never indicated she had any kind of arrest power. The issue with the I have a police car was said with air quotes, and she never displayed any kind of badge to the Officer Bauer. Now, the issue really is what the district court dealt with early on in its order, and they dealt with what happened the day before, which led to all this. On the day before, apparently my client's car was seen, or the license plate at least, was in Virginia. There was an allegation from a citizen that using lights in the car had run a person off the road or something like that and impersonated a police officer. Now, firstly, if Officer Bauer had found that person that day within a half hour or so, or you know, after the 911 came out, and did everything he was supposed to do, didn't find any lights or anything like that and couldn't substantiate it, but nonetheless arrested that person, you know, I wouldn't be here because, you know, he has a right to make a mistake based upon a split-second decision. But in this particular case, the next day, when he tracked down my client, and she voluntarily came back to Virginia from Maryland, and said, you can inspect my car. He did a full inspection of the car as much as he wanted to, and when doing so, did not find anything that was there. Now, my client, along with her former husband, became a little upset, wanted to know who the complaining witness was for their own purposes, were not told, and then finally left the scene. Now, at the scene, the record shows that my client never displayed a badge at all, didn't do anything to violate the statute, nothing at all. Thereafter, the next day, Officer Bauer continues his investigation, and he calls McCotter Jacobs over the same agency and verifies a lot of the same facts. She is the deputy director, the number two person. She does have uniform and non-uniform persons under her authority. Verifies all that. There's a dispute that the court, the district court, and my colleague have made very clear in the record that there is a question about whether or not she had the authority to have a badge. But if you look in the record and look at the opinion of, strike that, the transcript of the trial where the director of corrections testified on behalf of the Commonwealth, he clearly said that she had the authority to use it for secondary identification. She had a badge. So all that was known early on in the matter, all of it. But despite that, Bauer continued to persist. And taking a look at the English case, as Judge King, as you've already said, the English case involves someone who used police power to stop a person, put a badge in this person's face, and got the person out of the car. It was only after then that the person sort of recognized them that the person ran off and said he wasn't that person, and he was prosecuted for that. He utilized police power. There is nothing in this record, anything in this record, to indicate Dr. Merchant used any kind of police power at any time to do anything. So I think the record's clear on that.
Your colleague there emphasizes or wants to emphasize the fact that she referred to professional courtesy.
That's correct.
Now, how do you explain that?
Let me explain. And this was brought out in the deposition and in the testimony of Bauer, who lives in Maryland. In Maryland, public safety involves police, fire, corrections, and other agencies. On the Virginia side, public safety does not involve corrections. So in her view, she was part of public safety. And the professional courtesy she was seeking was that of someone else in public safety. So the issue, the first prong, is whether or not there was probable cause. And using a reasonable person test, what would a reasonable police officer find in these circumstances where he did not have to make a split-second decision when he ultimately got the warrant to arrest her, was whether or not she did anything to exhibit that she was falsely representing herself or basically faking to be a police officer. And I submit, as the district court did, there is nothing in the record to suggest that at all. So going to the second test under Saucier and all and the rest of the cases, the question is then, well, what is reasonable under the context of this case for showing of a violation of the law? What is reasonable? And I submit that when you take a look at this case in context, you're going to find that Officer Bauer violated a clearly established right in this matter. And here are the facts that are very, very clear and are undisputed. He knew all these things about what her position was all the way along down the line. He knew all that, but he nonetheless went forward and seeking protection under a Torchinsky analysis that this court has talked about in Waston, he went to people in the Commonwealth Attorney's Office and even to a magistrate. But as the district court clearly made a finding of, there's no evidence, there's no support in the record about what former Commonwealth Attorney Rodway was told, what he said. He didn't make any affidavit. The same thing is true for the magistrate judge. Police officers don't have to be perfect. They don't, and I'm not submitting that I'm looking for them to be perfect in every case. But in this particular case, I think it's very clear that what he did was talk to them to get some clearance, and then at the end of the day, go forward and arrest someone who clearly did nothing wrong, and everything she said was consistent with the truth. The only issue of fact is whether or not she was authorized to have a badge. And I submit at the trial in this case, the director of corrections made it very clear that she could have a badge, and she used it as secondary identification. So there's nothing close to English in this case, nothing close to violation of the clear meaning of the statute.
What about Watkins versus Arnold, where the case down in Western Virginia where the officer went to the prosecutor?
Right, and I think in that particular case, the officer had enough information, verified it, just like the officer did in Cloninger, that was the case before this court as well, that they got enough information, and even if they were wrong, no one can fault them for doing what they did along the way. And the difference also, I think, is that when we take a look at all of the Purnell cases, and specifically Purnell 3, that this court just decided this past summer, we're not talking about, even like there was in Purnell, a split-second decision that this officer had to make. This officer had a week between the inspection of the car and the ultimate arrest to gather the facts. So there's no rush here. And again, and even in Purnell 1, 2, and 3, this 3 to 5 second time period where this person who was going to be arrested on a misdemeanor warrant for failing to pay child support, I guess, trots or runs away and is shot the police officer thought was a taser, but turned out to be actually a Glock. That was the question of ultimately of objectivity and a question of reasonableness. And I think the district court did the right thing here by saying, again, there was no emergent situation here, and he had a week to do what he did. And what he did really was not objectionably reasonable under the facts and circumstances of this case. So I think taking those into consideration, it's very, very clear that the district court looked at the evidence very carefully, obviously analyzed the law extremely well, and came to through the right conclusion. The last thing that I think that I want to stress is that the Torchinsky cases and like where, you know, the officer goes and gets a warrant and talks to supervisors and things like that, it's a little bit different from this case because, again, this police officer did something that I dare say I've never heard of. Maybe it's common practice in Fairfax. He did his own legal research to determine whether or not he had probable cause. And I think when we get into that situation where police officers are acting like prosecutors, I think it makes it bad for all police officers and prosecutors alike. I just think this is a situation where Officer Bauer, the only defendant in this case, overstepped his bounds, and what he did was just not objectionably reasonable. And for those reasons, and the reasons that are in this record, I ask that you remand this case for a trial so that all these issues can be determined, and Dr. Merchant can have her day in court. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bynum. Mr. Jackowitz.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple comments on what Mr. Bynum said. First of all, the issue about the supervisor testifying at the General District Court trial in Fairfax that she had a badge, Judge Ellis correctly ruled that that was immaterial to this case because it happened after the fact. That's not something the officer knew at the time that he made the arrest. I just want to be clear on that. That's also pointed out in my briefing. Second of all, what Dr. Merchant thought she meant by public safety is, again, immaterial. What's material is what an objectively reasonable law enforcement officer could have taken that statement to mean. And I would just reiterate, while there is no dispute that corrections and civilian people in corrections could be in public safety, there's also no dispute that somebody who's a uniformed officer could be in public safety. So there's given the joints. And the question, again, is could a reasonable officer on these facts have come to the conclusion that my client did?
But
that's not to say
a crime once you find out that she really is a deputy correction officer. How would it be a crime if that's what you asserted and he found out that was true? That's what I'm saying. How
But Your Honor, the problem is that he found out that she was a civilian and not a law enforcement officer. That's the problem that I think my client had, and I think that's really the issue.
So he was that upset about that?
He wasn't upset.
Well, he wasn't?
No, sir. He's probably the least upset person about this lawsuit, if you can believe it.
He did. So the fine point is that he felt she shouldn't have even said anything about where she worked. Correct?
No, sir. I don't. I think the problem is you have to look at the statements as in a series, which is what he did. He looked at those statements collectively, and he concluded that they were suggestive, to use the word of Virginia Court of Appeals in English, that she was an imposter. He also had these statements in the fact that when he asked her about the badge, she didn't show it to him. From his perspective, which is the perspective of the reasonable law enforcement officer, that doesn't seem right. Usually, you know, my understanding is that if somebody's in law enforcement and they've got a badge, the minute they get pulled over or something, that badge is up in the window.
Is that the way they do it?
That's my understanding from some people that I work with.
Is that in this record? Or
no, sir. No, that's not in the record. I'm
what
just.
What do you tell them? They ask you what your occupation is before you.
Yeah, I mean.
You tell them I'm a lawyer.
Right.
Or would you say I'm a prosecutor?
Well, I'm not sure. I've never been a prosecutor. I've only been a lawyer. But I do think that a reasonable officer could think that when somebody asks for professional courtesy and they've told him the other things that they've said that they are and they've got a badge, that they're suggesting that they're in law enforcement, that right. There is that suggestion. And I think that the problem here is Mr. Bynum talks about how the law is clearly established. Well, no, it's not. There's one case. And that case does seem to suggest that there can be situations where somebody implies it or insinuates it rather than coming directly out and saying something like, I'm a police officer, which, you know, in a dishonest fashion.
She didn't say she was a police officer.
No, but
he said she was a public safety officer or whatever it was.
Yes, sir.
She was the number two person in corrections.
Right.
In Maryland.
But my
it was true.
It was the truth,
it was
but
true.
Well, some of it. But the problem was that in his mind, when he's told that she's a civilian, and she doesn't have a badge, and that only some people have badges. I think a reasonable officer could arrive at a different conclusion.
With a badge.
Well, he did see her with the badge in her hand.
The boss over there says she was authorized to carry a badge.
That wasn't until later.
That was not until later.
Yeah, that wasn't until later.
He was under the impression she did have a badge. That's what he says.
Yeah, she had a badge.
You're on both sides of it.
No, no, I don't believe so, sir. And I'm sorry if I haven't been clear. I mean, she had a badge.
He saw her with a badge.
Right, and he asked
but
her.
But he arrested her in part because she wasn't entitled to carry a badge. But her boss says she is entitled to have a badge, which he didn't take the opportunity to find out about, I guess.
Right, and that's not, and again, the part about the boss is not in the record. At this point, that's not in the record.
I mean,
at this point.
Another issue like, you all could argue about
before
the jury, I guess.
Well, that's true, I'd like to just focus on Watkins versus Arnold, sort of the second part of that for a minute, because Mr. Bynum said a lot about the issue of, well, there's nothing in the record about what he told the magistrate or what he told the deputy commonwealth's attorney. And Watkins versus Arnold makes very clear that that's not really the issue. The same concern was raised in that case. In that case, the district judge was only showed, I think, photos of the checks. And the district judge said, well, gee, I don't think that's enough. I think that needs to go to a jury. I'm going to deny summary judgment. And the court said, no, we think that the district judge was too concerned about that. You know, what's really important is that a prosecutor said, go get the warrants. And the other thing is the Fourth Circuit said was, there's no evidence in this record that there was any bad faith on the part of the officer, that the officer tried to mislead the Commonwealth's attorney, that he didn't tell him all the facts. And that's basically the situation we have here.
So let me see if I,
yeah.
if I
yes,
got
sir.
This all clear.
Okay.
The question, am I correct that the question here is, could a reasonable officer have believed that there was probable cause to seek an arrest warrant for her?
I couldn't say that any better. Okay. I'm not going to try.
Right. And your position here is that as a matter of law, it's not even disputable. It's not debatable. Is that essentially your position?
Well, yeah.
That he's entitled to qualified immunity because there was probable cause.
No, my...
Because a reasonable officer
yes, sir.
Could
You've
believe
got
there
it.
Was
probable cause. That's so, exactly right.
So you're...
Sir.
You don't contend there has to be probable
cause. No. In fact, I would argue we don't need to worry about probable cause in this case. This is a situation that, you know, the Supreme Court...
But what we would be saying to police officers, essentially, is that if it's close enough for government work, you're going to be okay.
I don't understand what you mean by close enough for government work.
You just said we don't have to worry about probable cause. You're saying Officer Bauer really didn't have to worry about probable cause.
Oh, no, I don't
think... Because you want an immunity doctrine that never puts before a jury the fact-intensive question of whether there's probable cause. I mean, your position is probable cause under Gates and that whole line of cases is already so watered down. And since qualified immunity waters it down further, because as you just said, officer doesn't really have to have probable cause. I mean, essentially, your position is there would never be a case where qualified immunity is denied where the question was probable cause, I guess is what you're saying.
That's not. I think my red light's on, but can I answer? Is that okay?
Please, that would be great.
The answer is that okay, Judge King?
Go right ahead.
Okay, yeah. Thank you, sir. No, that's not what I'm saying. I mean, it's a two-step analysis, and I think again, Torchinsky is a good example of this. Where
you keep mentioning the cases.
Yes,
let's
sir.
Imagine this is the first case. Forget for just a second.
Okay.
Forget the precedents. How do you argue this case is the first case?
I argue it that there's two separate issues there. The first issue is whether or not there's probable cause. The second issue is whether an objectively reasonable officer could believe there's probable cause, which pushes the boundaries out a little bit further. But it doesn't swallow probable cause, which is, I think, what you're concerned about. And I think this court, by some of its prior precedents, as well as what the Supreme Court has said in Pearson and more recently in El Cid, which I cited in my brief, has made it clear that you pick which way to go. And I would argue in this case the way to go is let's put aside whether there was probable cause or not. Let's focus on the question as you presented it, which is, again, I can't say it better than you did, Judge Davis. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, both of you.